Chapter 34. John Milton sat in the threadbare armchair in the front room of the house, staring at the stains on the wall and thinking. He had left Blissett House soon after Elijah. Sharon had been upset at the confrontation and, apologising as she did so, told him that it was probably better if he left. She said that what had happened had been a good thing and that she didn't regret it, but that she had to put her child first. Milton understood. He had not planned for the night to develop as it had, and he had been surprised at his reaction. There was something about her that drew him in. Her endearing combination of quiet dignity and vulnerability, perhaps. She was attractive, but he wished he had shown more restraint. Elijah had been making progress, and now he didn't know how much damage had been done. His mobile was on the table. It started to ring. Milton picked it up and checked the display. He did not recognise the number.
"Yes," he said. "Hello," said the caller. "Who's this?"
"You're the man.
The man in the park."
"Who's this?"
"I met you a week ago. You were looking for Elijah?"
"Which one are you?"
"You gave me your number."
Milton remembered the boy, older than the others, bigger, a strange mixture of tranquility and threat in his expression.
"I remember," he said. "What's your name?"
"Call me Pops."
"No, your real name." There was a pause as the boy weighed up whether he should say.
"Aaron," he said eventually.
"All right then, Aaron. I'm John. How can I help you?"
The boy's voice was tight, tense.
"You were looking out for Jar Jar, weren't you? You wanted to help him?"
There was something in the boy's tone that made him fearful.
"What about him?"
"He's in trouble. He's in real trouble, man. Serious."
There was a pause.
"Shit. I'm in trouble too. Both of us."
"You better tell me about it. What's the matter?"
"Just so I know, you ain't a journalist, are you?"
"No."
"And you ain't no police, neither?"
"No."
"What'd you do then? You so sure you can help?"
"I can't tell you that, but all you need to know is that I have a particular set of skills and that if you're in trouble, then I can help you. Beyond that, you'll have to trust me."
There was a pause on the line and Milton noticed that he was holding his breath.
"Are you still there?"
"Yeah,"
the boy said. "I'm here."
"It sounds like we need to talk."
"Yeah."
"Can we meet?"
"Of course."
"Now?"
"I'm in a park, next to the fountains. You around?"
"I can be."
"I'll be here for another 30 minutes then."
The boy ended the call without saying anything else. Milton walked the short distance to Victoria Park and made his way to the fountain. It had been another stifling day and the grass was parched and flattened in squares where picnic blankets had been stretched across it. The night was darkening. The wide expanse is gloomy between the amber cones from the occasional street lamp. A jumbo jet slid across the gloaming, its lights winking red as it curled away to the west. The big estate buildings on the southern edges of the park hunched over the fringe of trees and railings, 20-storey blocks of concrete, depressingly stolid, oppressive. It was a changing of the guard. The last joggers, cyclists and dog walkers passed around the outer circle as groups of youngsters gathered on the benches beneath the street lamps to smoke and joke with one another. Milton noticed all of them, a habitual caution so ingrained that he did not even realise it, but he paid them no heed. He followed the outer circle around from the pub and then took the diagonal path that cut straight to the memorial and the glassy squares of water that attended it. A homeless man sat at one of the benches massaging the ears of the thin greyhound huddling next to him. There was no one else. Milton walked slowly around the monument, making a show of examining it before sitting at one of the empty benches to fuss with a lace that did not need tying. The water was still and flat and perfectly reflective, a rind of moon floating in the shallow depth. He set to waiting.
20 minutes passed before he looked up to see someone else turn off the outer path and head towards the monument. Despite the late heat, the figure was wearing a bomber jacket over the top of a hoodie, the hood pulled over the head like a cowl. Pristine white trainers almost shone in the gloom. Milton got up from the bench and idled towards the monument. As the boy got closer, he recognised the face beneath the hood. His skin was black and perfectly smooth, his eyes and teeth shining.
"Aye,"
the boy said in a low monotone, angling his head in greeting. "Hello, Aaron."
"We can head towards the pond over there. Ain't no one there this time of the day."
They set off side by side. Milton studied the boy through the corner of his eye. He was large, not much shorter than Milton, but heavier, and he walked with a roll to his step, his head and shoulders slouched forwards. He dressed like all the others, hooded jacket, low-slung jeans with the crotch somewhere between his knees, the brand new trainers, pieces of expensive jewellery. It was the uniform of the gang, topped off by the purple bandana knotted around his throat. He wore it all naturally. He was quiet and composed, his eyes on the path. They continued that way for a minute, Milton happy to wait until the boy was ready to speak. They were approaching the pond when he finally spoke.
"Jaja needs help," he said. "He's got in with a bad man. I tried to keep him out of it, but he ain't listening to me anymore. Ain't nothing else I can do for him." "Is it business? You know him?"
"Elijah spoke to me after he was arrested. I know a little about him. Is he dangerous?"
"What, man, are you fucking high? Is he dangerous? Seriously? Business is a psycho, innit? He was always bad, but since his ego got to be like it is now, he's turned into a monster."
"What about you? What about me? You said you needed help too?"
He cleared his throat awkwardly.
"Business is the same age as I am. We were at school together. We used to be tight, but we ain't no more. And he's finished with me. I dunno, the last few weeks it's as if he's been provoking me, starting hype like he wants to get a reaction. I've seen it happen before. He don't let anyone get too influential, start taking his thunder, see. And then, when they do, when he thinks they might be getting to be a threat."
He clicked his fingers. "Then he gets rid of them, one way or another."
"And you're a threat?"
"Nah, man, I ain't like that. I want out, but he don't know that."
"So tell him."
He laughed bitterly. "Don't work that way, man. You get in, you're all the way in. You ain't done until he tells you you're done. And there ain't no talking with him."
Milton reflected that he knew what that felt like. He said nothing.
"Look, it ain't about me, not really. I am getting out, whether he likes it or not. It's the younger who needs help."
They reached the pond. A sign describing the nearby flora and fauna had been defaced with graffiti. Milton guessed that the 925 was a rival gang tag, and the bracket that should have held the buoyancy aid had been vandalised, snapped wood showing white through the creosote like splintered bone. Pop sat down on the bench and took a joint from his pocket.
"I come down here now and again," he said, lighting the joint with his lighter. "I know it sounds pathetic, but I used to be in the scouts when I was younger."
"The fucking scouts.
We used to come down here once a year and dredge the whole lot. You wouldn't believe the things people used to dump. Washing machines, shopping trolleys, everything covered in sludge and weeds. We always joked we'd pull out a dead body one day. What I know now, I'm half surprised we never did. There are guns and shanks in there, I know that for a fact."
The boy offered the joint to Milton. He shook his head. The boy shrugged and smoked hard on it instead.
"So tell me about Elijah."
"You know about what happened at the party," he told me. "There's a man business wants to have shot. Judge, I mentioned Wiley.
A little.
Business has got beef with him. Wants him gone. That was what the club was all about. He wants Jaja to do it. He had the gun that night. I thought I'd got through to him.
I sent him home when I saw what was happening. I thought he'd listen to me. Something must have happened since.
His voice trailed off. Milton said nothing.
So then I got a call from business yesterday to say I had to pick Jar Jar up and bring him to his studio. I never seen the younger like that before. He was angry, man. He had this proper screw face on like he was ready to fucking explode. Business loves that course, and he asks him whether he's ready to do what he wants him to do with Wiley.
A dog walker skirted the far side of the pond. His dog, a pit bull heavy with a fat collar of muscle, chased the ducks into the water.
And Elijah said he'd do it.
Pops nodded. Milton felt sick in the pit of his stomach.
When? I don't know the details. Business won't tell me. I'm not that close to him, and I don't think he trusts me no more anyway.
Is there anything else?
Can't think of nothing.
He paused. Except...
Go on.
The boy clenched his teeth so hard that the strong line of his jaw jutted from his face.
My girl's got involved with him too. She's vulnerable. Got a weakness for drugs, and he won't look out for her like I did. Last time I saw her, she was smoking crack with him. It'll be Skag next. She'll end up on the streets for him. I've seen that before too. Or she'll end up raped or dead.
Milton sat quietly.
So what are you going to do?
I don't know, Milton said.
You said you could help me, man.
I will. But you have to work with me.
How?
First things first. You have to speak to the police. Pops kissed his teeth.
Go to the feds. You know what would happen to me if business found out I'd been grassing. I'd end up in that fucking pond with a bullet between my eyes.
Pops stood abruptly.
If that's the best you can do, we're finished. Police aren't going to do nothing until Jar Jar's got blood on his hands and my girl is fucking dead. I'm wasting my time with this bullshit.
Grow up, Aaron, Milton said. His voice was emotionless, iron hard, and utterly authoritative.
Sit down.
He did as he was told, adding self-pityingly,
What's the point?
Because I'm going to take him out of the picture, Milton said. Tell them what happened at the club.
The boy who got beaten, you saw all that?
Pops looked down at his feet.
Yeah, man, I saw it.
That's good, Milton said. They'll have to take that seriously.
What you gonna do?
I'm gonna have a word with business.
He laughed. A word? No offence, man, but he ain't going to listen to you.
He'll listen to me, Milton said. You'll have to trust me about that. Milton stood and they started back towards the main road.
This is what we're going to do.
You're going to go to the police and tell them about what happened at the club. Leave Elijah out of it, but tell them everything else.
It won't do nothing. It'll be my word against theirs.
Maybe. But it will be a useful distraction.
And then what?
You'll get your friend off balance, just as I give him something else to think about. I want him to take me seriously when we speak. I'm going to need some information from you about how his operation is put together, who works for him, how he makes his money, where he keeps it. Can you help me with that?
Yeah?
Milton asked a series of questions, and Pops provided awkward but reasonably comprehensive answers. Milton memorized the information, filtering it and arranging it as he built up a picture of business's business. The man had numerous interests in the local underworld, his malign influence stretching from drugs to prostitution and robbery. His music was clearly lucrative, but it would be as nothing compared to the profit he was turning from his illegal businesses. It was good that he was spread among different businesses and areas. That would mean that there would be plenty of vulnerable spots that Milton would be able to exploit.
How does he communicate with everyone?
Pops looked at him derisively.
How'd you think, man? Smoke signals, homing pigeons? Facebook, BBM, texts. Pay-as-you-go phones. Nothing he could ever get nailed with by the feds if they got hold of it. If he needs to meet to talk business, he'll get someone else to make the call to set it up and then arrange the meet somewhere in the open where it's impossible for the boy of them to bug him.
He's careful, man. Precise. Plans everything like he's in the military or something.
Police think their old ways still work, but people, the real players like him, man, they've been around long enough to have seen brothers get nicked all sorts of different ways, and they remember all of them. You've got to get up early to pull a fast one on him.
They reached the fringe of trees that provided a canopy of leaves over the path at the outer edge of the park. The pub at the junction was growing busier, with loud customers spilling into a beer garden decorated with fairy lights.
All right, Milton said. That's enough for now. Go to the police tomorrow, all right?
Yeah,
Pop said sullenly. Don't let me down. It's important.
Aye, he conceded. Tomorrow. When will I know you've done something?
You'll know.
Chapter 35. Milton took the underground to Oxford Circus and emerged blinking into the hard, bright light of another stifling summer's day. The temperature had continued its inexorable uptick into the mid-30s, but now it had become damply humid, a wetness that quickly gathered beneath Milton's armpits and seeped down the middle of his back. The atmosphere lay heavy over the city, a woozy stupor that could only be alleviated with the inevitable thunderstorm that the forecast was predicting for later. The Sig Sauer, in its chamois holster, was a heavy, warm lump beneath Milton's shoulder. The air in the tube had been cloying and dense, and Milton was pleased to have left it behind him. The confluence of Regent Street and Oxford Street was a busy scrum of sluggish tourists and frustrated office workers on their lunch breaks. Traffic jammed at the lights, taxi drivers leaning on their horns to chivvy along the buses that tarried to embark passengers. Tempers were stretched as tight as piano wire, arguments flaring and confrontations held just beneath the surface. Milton's phone vibrated in his pocket.
Hello? He said.
Is that John?
Who's this?
Rutherford. Is everything all right?
I'm a little busy.
It's Saturday afternoon. I've been expecting your boy to come for training, but there ain't no sign of him. What's happening?
There's been a setback, Milton said as he crossed the road at the lights. I'm taking care of it. I have to go.
Milton ended the call. He turned in the direction of the tall, crenulated finger of Centrepoint. HMV was 50 yards along the rows, the sound of heavy bass throbbing from the wide-open doorway into the cavernous space beyond. Milton surveyed the interior, racks of music and films, T-shirts, magazines, and, on a stage that had been erected in the middle of the shop, a table and a tall stack of CDs. A long queue of youngsters, mostly young boys but also a handful of girls, snaked back from the table around the aisles and back almost to the entrance. Behind the table sat six members of BRAP. The collection comprised the better-known members of the collective, MC Mafia, Merlin, Icarus, Bredren. The female singer Loletta sat in the middle, haughty with her strikingly good looks, a highlight for the hormonal teenage boys who waited to be presented to her. Milton recognised business from the pictures on his Facebook and Twitter profiles. He was wearing a Chicago Bulls singlet, the top revealing an angular torso. Long, skinny arms with the sharp points of his elbows and shoulders. His skin was extensively tattooed, and gold teeth glittered on the rare occasion when he disturbed the studied blankness of his expression to smile. He sat at the head of the table, the last member of the collective to receive the fans, like a king or a mafia don accepting the fealty of his subjects. They came to him, wide-eyed and open-mouthed, their CDs passed along the table with him finally adding his mark and sending them on their way. He spoke with some, bumped fists with others, but all left elated by their encounter with their hero. Milton could see quite clearly the power that the man, and the lifestyle he typified, had on them. He was an aspirational figure, living proof that the success he rapped about was possible to have. Milton did not respect him for this, but he recognised it and its influence, and filed it away for future reference. A large display had been erected at the front of the shop, loaded with the collective's new album and an assortment of other merchandise. Milton took a copy of the record and a T-shirt and joined the end of the queue. It was moving slowly, and Milton guessed it would take half an hour to get to the front. He did not have the patience to wait for that, and taking advantage of the fact that it would have been difficult to imagine anyone less likely to jump the queue, he made his way to the front.
"One minute," he said to the two young boys who were about to go forwards. "I just need a quick word with him, won't hold you up long."
The table was fenced in by crowd control barriers, and two large bouncers stood guard at the entrance to the enclosure. They glared at him as he passed between them. Milton passed along the table, ignoring the others and making his way directly to business. He stopped in front of him.
"Good afternoon."
Business bared his teeth in a feral grin, the golden cap sparkling.
"Look at this,"
he laughed, jutting his chin towards Milton. The others laughed too.
"You're in the wrong section, man. All folks' music is over there."
"No, it's you I want to see."
Business threw up his hands and chuckled again.
"Fine, bruv. Where's your record then? Give it here. What you want me to say?"
"I'm not here about your music."
"Come on, man, enough of this bullshit. If you ain't got nothing to sign, get the fuck out of the way. Lot of brothers and sisters here been queuing hours to see us. You're gonna end up causing a motherfucking riot. You don't stop slowing the queue down."
"I need to talk to you. And you're going to listen to what I have to say."
"The fuck?"
Milton ignored him. He stared at business, his eyes icy and unblinking, with no life or empathy in them, until the confusion on the younger man's face faded and a cloud of anger replaced it.
"I'm going to ask you nicely for two things," Milton said. "First, a woman named Laura has been associating with you. You're going to stop seeing her. If she comes to visit you, you are going to send her away."
"That's your first thing. All right, go on. You're an entertaining fucker. What's the second thing?"
"I know what you're planning for a young lad I know. Elijah Warriner. You call him Jar Jar. That is not going to happen. You are to stop seeing him too. If I hear that you have been seen with him, there is going to be trouble. If just one hair on his head is hurt, we're going to have another conversation, but it won't be as civil as this one."
"You hear this, motherfucker?"
Business hooted at the others. They were all watching the exchange.
"You asking me nicely, right? You better tell me, old man, just so I know, what you going to do if I tell you to take your requests and shove them right up your ass? Tell me not so nicely, raise your voice. Get out of here before you make me lose my temper. I ain't got time for this."
The bouncers took a step towards Milton, but business stayed them with an impatient wave of his hand. Milton did not look at them. He did not move away from the table.
"You won't take me seriously now, but I'm going to give you a demonstration tonight of what will happen if you ignore my instructions. Something is going to happen to your interests, and I want you to think of me and what I've told you when you hear about it. Do you understand?"
Business surged up from his chair so quickly that it clattered behind him.
"Do I understand?"
Any vestige of his previous joviality was banished now, his eyes blazing with anger.
"You come in here with my brothers around me and you start making threats? Shit, man, you're the dumbest motherfucker I ever met. I'm gonna tell you one more time. Get the fuck out of this shop before I throw you out my goddamn self. Do you understand?"
Business stepped around the table and took a step towards Milton. He did not flinch and, instead, fixed his pitiless stare on business's face.
"I've said what I needed to say. I hope you understand. I hope you remember. Do what I've told you, or the next time won't be so pleasant."
Business drew his fist back, Milton caught it around his ear before he could throw a punch and dug his thumb and index finger into the pressure point. Business yelped at the abrupt stab of white-hot pain and stumbled backwards, bouncing against the trestle table. The pile of posters tipped over, a glossy tide of paper that fanned out across the floor. "Tonight," said Milton, smiling down at Business, a cold smile that was completely without humour. "Pay attention tonight. I want you to think of me." He made his way to the front of the shop. Part 4. Risky Business. Chapter 36. Milton pulled over, extinguished the lights of the car, and switched off the engine. He left the radio on so that he could finish listening to the news. The bulletin reported that a protest outside a police station in Tottenham had deteriorated into a riot. Relatives of a man who had been shot by police 2 days earlier had gathered to protest his killing. Others had joined in, and the crowd had started to pelt the police with bottles and bricks. There were reports that cars and a double-decker bus had been set alight. Milton drew down on the cigarette he was smoking and blew the smoke out of the window. It was a hot night, close and humid. There was something in the air, a droning buzz of aggression. It wouldn't take much to ignite it. He switched off the radio, opened the glove compartment, took out his holstered knife and pulled up the sleeve of his right trouser leg. He wrapped the holster around his calf and fastened the Velcro straps. He checked in his mirrors that the pavement outside was empty and, satisfied that he would not be observed, he took his Sig Sauer from its holster and checked the magazine. It was full. He pumped a bullet into the chamber so that the gun was ready to fire. He slid it back beneath his armpit. He looked around again. This part of Dawson Lane comprised a Georgian terrace of tall, two-story houses with Victorian shop fronts that had been built over their front gardens when the railways arrived 100 years earlier. The houses behind the shops had recently been used for social housing, but as time passed and their tenants were moved into the high-rise blocks that dominated the nearby skyline, they had been allowed to begin their long slide into decrepitude. Those that were left vacant were boarded up. Damaged roofs were left unrepaired. Windows were shattered and left open to the rain. 4 houses had been gutted by fire, the exposed bricks crusted black with soot and ash, and the timbers exposed like cracked and broken bones. Those buildings had been condemned and demolished, tearing holes in the terrace like the teeth yanked from a cancerous mouth. Boards had been erected around the blackened remnants of the extension, and these had been scarified by graffiti and posters for illegal raves. The Victorian extensions were occupied by local businesses. The entire house and extension at the corner of the road was a doctor's surgery, with bars on the door and the windows plastered with posters about sexually transmitted diseases and nutrition. Next to that was an Indian restaurant, then a shop selling musical instruments, a laundromat, a business selling second-hand kitchen equipment, then a newsagent. Adjacent to that, a facade announced the Star Bakery, but the shutters had been in place for so long that the rust had fastened the padlocks to their tethers. The property alongside had seen its extension occupied by a squatter. It had been a bicycle shop years before, the block typography of its original frontage still visible despite the etiolation of the weather and the fumes from the busy road. The wide picture windows were obscured by sheets of newspaper and a printed notice that had been glued to the door declared that the squatters enjoyed rights of occupation and could not be evicted without a court order. Milton scanned it all quickly. The terrace behind the squat was one of business's most profitable crack houses. Pops had told him everything. Heroin and crack were sold around the clock, rain or shine. Most of the customers were poor locals, drawn in from the surrounding estates, but a significant minority of the customers were white, very often professional and middle class. Milton got out of the car. He went around to the back, opened the boot and took out a jerry can that he had filled with petrol from the garage on Mare Street. There was no sense in making his entry through the front door. It looked as if it was locked. Just enough of a delay to allow for escape should the police arrive for a clean-up. Milton had another idea. The terrace was listed, and the plans were available online. He had visited the library and downloaded them, reviewing them before he came out. He knew that there was another way in. He followed the road to the junction, taking a right turn, and then, before he reached a tawdry pub, another sharp right. A narrow cul-de-sac led around the back of the terrace. Overflowing dustbins were stacked up against the wall, and detritus had been allowed to gather in the gutter. Each house had a rear entrance, and the one that served the crack house was wide open. Silly boys. Milton took out his cig and went inside. The first room used to be a kitchen. Old appliances had been left to rot, with anything that could be easily removed long since sold for scrap. The walls were partially stripped and scabbed with lead paint, and the remnants of a twee wallpaper that depicted an alpine scene had been left to peel away like patches of dead flaking skin. Empty cardboard boxes and fast food wrappers were scattered on the floor. A single man, strung out and emaciated, was slumped against the wall. He was unconscious, and Milton would not have been able to say whether he was dead or alive. He heard low conversation from the front of the house and set off towards it. The junkie's arm swept around sharply, and his eyes swam with drunken stupor, but he paid Milton no heed as he passed through the room. He moved through a hallway with a flight of stairs leading up to the first floor. Patterned linoleum was scattered with drug paraphernalia. A mattress rested upright against the wall. Another junkie was asleep on the floor. Milton tightened the grip on the butt of his pistol as he stepped carefully around him. The noises were coming from the front extension. Milton paused in the shadows at the doorway to assess his surroundings. The only furniture was a sofa and a huge monolithic television. It was a big unit with a cathode ray tube, and it had been left on, badly tuned, scenes from a soap occasionally resolving out of the distortion of static. The front door was ahead of him, barricaded with an old sideboard that had been propped against it. Vivid wallpaper with a woodland design had been hung on the wall, the paper stained yellow by months of smoke. There was no ventilation, and the atmosphere was thick and heavy, woozy, a sickly miasma. There were a dozen people inside the room. Men and women, mostly supine, their heads lolling insensately, unfocused eyes lazily flicking across the television screen. They were all black, dressed cheaply, feeble and thin. Plastic bottles were arranged in neat rows, each of them full of urine. A collection of shoes, random and unpaired, was pushed into one corner. Empty vials of crack had been ground underfoot, crunching like fresh snow, as the addicts shuffled across the room to the two men who were sat on the sofa. They were clear-eyed and moved with crisp purpose as they exchanged vials of crack for their customers' crumpled banknotes. They were younger than their patrons, Milton guessed in their late teens, not long out of school. They were dressed in low-slung jeans, the crotch hanging down between the knees. There were diamond ear studs and golden chains, and both wore the colourful purple bandana of the LFB around their necks. These were the dealers, one step up from the shotters, businesses' representatives on the street. They sold the drugs and then protected the house so that their customers had somewhere to get high and then buy from them again. Milton shuddered in revulsion. He assessed the situation. The junkies were too far gone to pose any kind of problem, and he discounted them. The two dealers looked fit and strong, and there was a kitchen knife resting on the arm of the sofa. That would be a problem if they could get to it before he had disabled them. He could not discount the possibility that they were armed either. Milton suddenly decided.
He sprang across the room and lashed out with the barrel of his pistol. He struck the bigger of the two men across the temple, a stunning blow that dropped him to his knees. The second man stretched across the sofa, but Milton had anticipated his move, firing out a kick that struck him in the side of the chest and brought a whistle of pain from him. The man's hand fell short, the knife dislodged from its perch by the attempt. Milton's hands grabbed the man in two places, bunching into his singlet and by waist of his trousers, and he heaved him off the sofa and onto the floor. The sharp edges of crushed vials and syringes bit into his face and throat as he tried to find his feet. Milton followed him to the floor, pinning the point of his knee between his shoulder blades and pressing down. He took the cig and pressed the barrel into the cornrows on the top of the man's head.
"Pay attention," he said. "I want you to deliver a message to business. Tell him that this is what I said would happen. If he doesn't do what I told him to do, tell him that this will keep happening. One crack house at a time. Do you understand? Nod if you do."
The man jerked his head awkwardly against the floor.
"All right. You are going to get up now, and you're going to clear these people out. Then you grab your friend over there and get him out too. If you do anything foolish, I'll shoot you. Understand?"
Milton got up and backed away. He took the jerry can and poured the petrol across the floor on the sofa, sloshing it across the thick curtains. If the boy needed motivation, Milton's self-evident plan was it. He did as he was told, ushering the crackheads out the back and then returning to collect his friend, propping him up and helping him away. The room quickly stank of petrol. Milton took out his lighter and thumbed it to flame. He played the lighter over a rag, and blue-white flame consumed it hungrily. Milton dropped it onto the sofa, and with a quiet exhalation, the fabric caught fire. The flame spread quickly over the upholstery, stretching higher and higher until it started to scorch the ceiling. It raced across the floor to the walls, a quiet crackling that quickly became a hungry roar, with black smoke billowing up to the roof and then spewing back down again. Milton went out into the alley gun first, only holstering the Sig Sauer when he saw that both boys had fled. He walked briskly, making his way back onto the main road and to his car. He unlocked the door and slipped inside. Across the street, the squat was burning fiercely. Chapter 37. Christopher Callan paused outside flat 609, and then, satisfied that it was the correct address, he knocked firmly three times on the door. He heard sounds of activity inside, the chink of pieces of crockery being knocked together, a door opening on a rusty hinge, and then footsteps approaching. A woman opened the door. Callan guessed that she was in her early 30s. Dark black hair, smooth skin, wide eyes, a slender build. She was wearing the uniform of a fast food chain. "Yes?" Callan smiled. "Excuse me. Sorry for disturbing you. Are you Sharon Warriner?" Her eyes narrowed. "Who's asking?" "I'm Detective Constable Travis." Her face fell. "It's Elijah, isn't it?" "Elijah? My boy. What's he done?"
"No, Mrs. Warriner. It's not that. Nothing to do with Elijah. Would it be all right if I came inside for a minute?"
"What's it about?"
She had the usual suspicion of the police, Callan saw. It was to be expected in a place like this. He reached into his jacket pocket and took out the file picture of Milton. "Do you know this man?" She became confused as she studied the picture.
"That's John."
"John Milton?"
"Yes, I don't understand. What's he done?"
"Can I come in, please? Just 5 minutes." She reluctantly stood aside and let him through. They passed through the small hallway and into the lounge. It was a large room, the decor a little tatty and tired, an old sofa, a table with four chairs, a flat-screen television. PlayStation games scattered across the floor. Sharon stood stiffly,
Her suspicion had not been assuaged. Callan could see that, and he was not going to be invited to sit. Fair enough. He wouldn't be long. In some ways, he had already seen enough.
How do you know Mr. Milton?
He's a friend.
How did you meet him?
She paused, her face washed by a moment of worried memory.
I just did, she said. What's this about, please? What's he doing here? I told you he's a friend. He's helping me with my son.
How?
I'm sorry, detective, but I don't understand how any of that is relevant. What has he done wrong?
I'm afraid I can't tell you that.
Please, how is he helping you?
She waved her hand agitatedly.
My boy, Elijah, he can be a bit of a handful, headstrong, like they all are at his age. Mr. Milton is...
She paused, searching for the right word, and then repeated the same one again.
Helping me with him, like I said. I don't understand why you're asking me. Has he done something wrong? Should I be worried?
Should she be concerned? Callan suppressed the smirk. She had no idea. None at all.
No,
he said. There's no reason to be concerned. I'm sorry I can't say any more than that.
She made for the door. Then I'm sorry, detective. If you can't tell me what Mr. Milton has done, then I'm not sure what else I can do to help.
She opened the door. Do you mind? I have to get ready for bed. I start work early in the mornings.
Of course, Callan said. Thank you for your help.
Sorry again for disturbing you. He looked around again as he allowed her to shepherd him to the door. Unpaid bills on the floor, paint peeling from the walls, bars across the windows. What was number one doing in a place like this, with a woman like this? He supposed that she was pretty after a fashion, but that wasn't a good enough reason to explain anything. The only thing that made any sense at all was Control's contention that something had broken inside number one's head, and that, if it was true, would not be good for him at all. He politely bid the woman good night and walked over to the balcony as she shut the door behind him. He rested his elbows on the balustrade and looked out over the East End. It was a hot night, the air torpid and sluggish. Sirens wailed in the streets nearby, and a group of youngsters had gathered in the open space below, their raucous laughter reaching up to him. Callan did not understand any of it. His task was to gather evidence, not to draw conclusions, yet he could not help but wonder what on earth had happened to number one.
Chapter 38. Stoke Newington Police Station was a modern three-story building with wide windows on the ground floor. They were all lit up, lights burning behind them. Pops walked towards the entrance but did not go in. They had one of those old-fashioned blue lanterns hanging from the wall, and he carried on beneath it and further along the road before he stopped, crossed over, and headed back in the same direction again. He had repeated the pattern for the last half an hour, passing up and down the tree-lined road, thinking about choices and consequences. What he was about to do would change everything for him. There was no point in pretending that it wouldn't, and the gravity of what he was contemplating frightened him. If he did as he had been asked to do, there would be no turning back for him. His life would be yanked off course and sent in a different direction. There was a Turkish barber shop opposite the station. He sat down, resting his back against the window, and took the half-finished joint from behind his ear. He held it in the flame of his lighter and toked on it until it caught, drawing in a big breath of smoke. He held it in his lungs for a long moment and then blew it away. He needed to settle down, to relax. He drew his legs up to his chest and leant forwards, resting his forehead against his knees. He was hopelessly on edge. Choices. He stared across the slow-moving traffic to the lit windows of the station. He knew that speaking to the police was a fundamental thing. It would make him a grass. He was at a junction. Consequences one way, but consequences the other way too. He had thought about it for long enough before he met Elijah, before business turned his back on him, before Laura, before Milton. There were always choices, even when you thought there were none. It had been his choice to join the LFB, to start mugging and steaming, to start selling drugs. There had been different choices at every point, but the problem was that those alternatives were harder or less lucrative or less cool than the life he could have on the street. He had told the youngers that came up that the easy way was the best way, but he had always known that the stories he told them were lies. He had always known. He lied to them and to himself. He had persuaded himself that he was right, but now, well, now there was nothing else for it but to face the truth. Because the truth of it was that there was always a choice. The shopkeeper had a small television above the counter, and Pops could hear it through the open door. There was nonsense in Tottenham tonight, brothers getting together and wrecking the place. He could hear the reporter speaking from the scene, the sound of yelling in the background, things getting smashed up. Pops listened absently to it for a moment, not really paying attention, toking on the joint and letting the smoke slowly seep out from his nostrils. He finished it, sucking the flame down to his fingertips and dropped it to the ground, grinding the roach underfoot. He crossed the street, pushed open the door and went inside. A female officer was on duty.
"How can we help you?"
she said.
"I want to talk to someone about Israel Brown."
The woman looked at him askance.
"Who's that then?"
"You probably know him as Business, the rapper. He beat a boy after death in Chimes last week. I was there. I saw it all."
Chapter 39. Business stared out of the tinted window of the BMW at the burnt-out house. A fire engine was still at the scene, a fireman playing water over the smoking wreckage. The ceiling of the extension had collapsed, and the window had buckled and shattered from the heat, revealing the blackened mess beyond. He didn't own the house, and it wasn't worth shit anyway, but that was not the point. It was Business's property. It served a purpose, and it made him a lot of paper. Now he was going to have to find somewhere else, spread the word, get things going again. It would cost him time and lose him money.
"Motherfucker,"
he said, slamming his fist against the steering wheel. Mouse was in the passenger seat.
"We got a problem, Business."
"You think? Shut the fuck up, Mouse. You don't know shit."
Levels and Tookie, the two boys who had been working the squat, had told him what had happened. The man had attacked the place just after midnight, taking them by surprise. He had beaten them both, passed on his message, cleared the junkies out, and fired the place. There would be a price to pay for that. The door behind them opened, and a man slid into the seat. Business glanced up in the rearview mirror. Detective Inspector Wilson glared back into his eyes.
"What's going on, lads? Who did this?"
"Someone who's going to wish they never got involved with me. You don't need to worry about it."
"You sure about that? Because I'm pretty sure that when the fire service confirmed that this is arson, there's going to be an investigation."
"Take it easy, aight? I know who did it, and I'm going to sort it."
"You better make sure that you do. You've got to keep a lid on things. Having one of your places go up like it's bonfire night isn't good for my blood pressure. You want to operate around here without any trouble from me, you keep things quiet."
"Nah, man. Me operating around here depends on you getting your cut every Friday."
Wilson ignored him and stabbed a finger against the window.
"Things like that don't give me much confidence, son.
I turn a blind eye to you because I don't have time to start worrying about lads from outside the postcode causing trouble. There are plenty of others who can keep a lid on things if you can't."
"That you making a threat?"
"No. That's me telling you that it's going to cost you 10 from now on if you want to stay in business."
"Fuck, man, don't give me that shit. You're doubling the fee."
There's a problem with that?
Business gripped the steering wheel hard.
Nah, he said. Ten's fine.
There are other benefits to working with me, Wilson said.
Yeah? Like what?
Advanced warnings.
You've got more trouble coming your way.
Your boy Pops, what about him?
He came into the Nick last night. Says he's willing to give evidence against you.
Against me?
So he says.
For what?
Beating up that kid in Chimes.
Man, that was nothing.
Tell that to the kid's parents. He's still in hospital.
Pops don't got shit.
He's saying he was there.
And he's gonna talk.
That's what I heard.
Business glowered through the tinted windscreen, watching as the passing cars slowed so that their drivers could gawp at the smoking wreck of the crack house. The problem with the man who did that, and now this. Timing was bad. Timing was awful. Business nodded grimly.
Fair enough, he thought. Timing was awful. But sometimes that's the way it was, the hand you got dealt.
They were two small problems, and they could both be sorted. He started to work out angles, tactics.
You've got to keep on top of things, son, Wilson said. Do I have a reason to be concerned?
No, he said, gritting his teeth.
No reason. It'll all get sorted.
Chapter 40. Pinky reached the door to Business's studio and pressed the intercom.
Yeah.
I'm here to see Business.
He ain't in good way.
Don't talk chat, bruv. I saw him come in.
Piss off, younger.
Nah, it's about what happened at HMV yesterday. I got some information.
You can tell me.
Don't think so, he said. I'll tell him myself or I won't bother.
There was a click as the intercom was switched off. Pinky paused, holding his breath. The intercom crackled into life again.
All right, come up.
The lock buzzed and the door clicked open. Pinky climbed the stairs, the framed Brap pictures on the walls on either side of him. He was nervous. Business had a reputation, a bad one. Everyone knew that. And part of that reputation was that he could be unpredictable. All the stories Pinky had heard about him were at the front of his mind. He wasn't stupid. He knew plenty of them were made up for the sake of his image, but there were others he knew were true, and it was those that he was thinking about now. He stepped through into the large room at the top of the stairs. Business was on the sofa, his feet propped up against the edge of the coffee table. A flat-screen television was fixed to the wall and tuned in to Sky News. Pinky had heard all about the riots that had started in Tottenham last night. He had been excited by it, at the idea of looting all those shops. Now it seemed like the trouble had spread to Enfield and Brixton. Footage from a helicopter showed a police car on fire.
What's your name, boy?
Pinky.
All right, Pinky. You better have a good reason for coming up here. I'm a busy man, lot on my plate. I ain't got no time for signing no autographs.
I'm not here for that, he said.
Then you better tell me what you are here for.
I got some information, he said. That old man who got into it with you at the record signing, I saw it on YouTube.
What?
Pinky took out his phone. He'd already queued up the video and now he hit play. The video rolled. Someone in the shop had filmed the conversation between Business and the old man. The camera was close enough to see the expressions on their faces, the implacability of the man, and Business's growing anger. Their argument reached its crescendo, and Business lost his balance, stumbling backwards and tripping. The sound of laughter came as he sprawled amid the spilled posters and CDs.
Who the fuck uploaded that?
He spat, grabbing the phone from out of Pinky's hand. There were several pages of comments, most of them jokes at Business's expense, and Pinky hoped that he would not read them. He did not. He played the video again and then tossed the phone back, his eyes flaring with anger.
It's about the man, Pinky said.
Business's eyes narrowed and the animation washed from his face. Pinky realized he would have to tread carefully.
Go on then. Don't just sit there. Tell me what you know.
There's a boy on the estate you've been asking him to do stuff for you. Jar Jar.
Yeah? What about him?
I was outside his mum's flat the day before yesterday. It was in the morning, early. We'd been up late selling shit to the cats. We was just about to call it a night. Anyway, right, I saw Elijah coming out looking all upset and shit. And then, right after him, out comes that man. It was definitely him, no doubt. He was half undressed, had his shirt off.
What are you saying? It's Elijah's dad?
Nah, his dad's in prison.
So who is it?
Dunno. His mum's a skanky hoe. Some bloke she picked up, I reckon.
Business zoned out as he tried to remember what the man had said to him.
He told me to stay away from the boy, he recalled.
Him and Pop's bitch, Mouse offered.
You know anything else? Business asked.
Nah, that's it. I thought it could be useful, so I came over.
It is useful, younger. I appreciate that. You making the effort. You done good.
There was another reason for coming, he said.
It had gone as well as he could have expected, and now here it was, the opportunity he had been hoping for.
Go on, Business said skeptically.
I've been thinking, Pinky said. I know you asked Jar Jar to do some things for you.
He left the things vague, but he knew all about the incident at the launch party.
Between you and me, boy ain't up to much. He's just a little kid, gets scared about things.
You ain't that much older yourself, younger.
Nah, true enough, but me and him ain't got nothing in common. There ain't nothing you could ask me to do for you that I wouldn't get done. You know what I'm saying? You want to ask around, people will tell you I'm reliable. I don't mess no one about. When I say I'm going to do something, I do it. You don't need to worry about it. Get sorted. You know what I'm saying?
That's so.
Yeah, he said. Thing is, I'm looking for a change. I'm ambitious, man, and I'm getting bored hanging around in the same old crew. I want to do mad shit, but Pops don't have his heart in it no more. We just hang around these ends doing the same tired old shit day after day. The way I see it, I could do that kind of stuff with you.
Business looked over at Mouse and grinned.
The balls on this one, eh? Reminds me of what I used to be like.
All you need to do is give me a chance. I promise I won't let you down.
You don't take no for an answer, do you?
Pinky shook his head.
All right. I'll tell you what, younger. There is something you could do for me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a crumpled £10 note.
First of all, though, I'm hungry. Go down to Mackie D's and get me a ready meal, eh? Here.
He handed him the note as the other boy started to laugh. Pinky felt the colour running into his cheeks. He pretended he wasn't bothered.
All right. Big Mac and a Coke. And be quick. I ain't eaten all day.
Chapter 41. Pops came out of the takeaway with a bucket of fried chicken. The boys were waiting outside, arranged around a bench opposite the parade of shops. Little Mark was cleaning his new Nikes with a piece of tissue. Kids, Chips and Pinky were hooting at a couple of pretty girls outside the laundrette. And Jar Jar was sitting facing half away from them, a scowl on his face. They were drinking a six-pack of beer that Little Mark had stuffed down the front of his jacket in the mini-market when they went in for chocolate earlier. Pops put the bucket down on the seat and took off the lid. He helped himself to a breast and bit into it. It was crisp, with just the right amount of grease to it. The others helped themselves.
I'm hungry,
Little Mark said.
You're fat,
Chips retorted.
Piss off, he said,
but his eyes shone. Little Mark didn't care if they teased him about his weight. He knew he was fat, he couldn't deny it, and he didn't care. He liked being the centre of attention.
I'm bored, Chip said.
Kids looked up.
What are we going to do then?
Dunno.
Go see a film?
Nah, nothing on, all shit.
What then?
Chips raised his voice.
See if those fine girls fancy hanging out.
The girls heard him, snorted with derision, and disappeared into the laundrette.
Something else, then?
Dunno.
Pops looked at Elijah. He glared back at him sullenly. His eyes were piercing, and for a moment he wondered if there could have been any way that he could have found out about his visit to the station. No, he thought, after a moment of worried consideration, no, there couldn't be. He had been careful. They would all know eventually, but not yet. Little Mark spoke through a mouthful of chicken.
We could go and look at that crack house. You seen that shit?
That place business ad.
So they say,
Chips said.
In Dalston?
Kids asked. Chips nodded.
What happened?
Burned to the ground,
Little Mark replied, fragments of fried chicken spilling out of the corner of his mouth.
Some guy turns up, beats the shit out of the two boys who were there to look after the place, pours petrol around the place and sets it off.
He spread his fingers wide.
Whoosh!
Who was it?
Fuck knows.
Some cat, probably. Didn't have any money for his fix and went mental or something.
Whoever that cat is, man, I would not want to be him when business gets hold of him.
That shit's going to be epic.
Medieval.
You should film it, stick it on YouTube. That's viral, innit?
Stop it happening again.
Nah,
Little Mark decided.
Can't be bothered. Dalston's too far and I'm still hungry.
You're always hungry, fat man.
It wasn't no cat who did it,
Chip said.
You hear what happened at the BRAP signing? Some old guy like in his 40s or some shit like that, he turns up in the queue and basically calls business out.
You see it?
Someone put it on YouTube. The old man goes toe-to-toe with him, stone cold, they have words, and he does this ninja death grip on his hand. Business ends up on his ass in front of everyone. What I heard, they reckon the guy who did that is the same guy who burned down the crack house.
He's a dead man,
kid said. You ain't wrong.
Elijah gave out an exasperated sigh.
You hear about it, Jar Jar?
Chip said.
Yeah.
What you reckon?
I reckon none of you know what you're talking about.
Pops watched the five of them, the easy banter that passed between them. Only Jar Jar was quiet, the rest joshing and ribbing each other without affectation or agenda. They were what they were, young boys caught in the awkward hinterland between being children and men. He felt a moment of mawkishness. He had grown up with them. They were his boys, yet his days as one of them were limited now. When they learned that he was going to give evidence against business, they would shun him as surely as if he had thumbed his nose at them personally. He would be a grass, and there would be beef between them, serious hype, and things could never be the same after that.
Pops, man,
kid said as he started on his second breast, grease smeared around his mouth.
What are we going to do?
His train of thought depressed him.
I don't know, he said, his voice blank. Do what you want.
We could steam a bus.
Up to you, innit?
What are you doing?
Stuff.
Little Mark looked at his BlackBerry.
Get this, he said. Just got a message from my boy in Hackney. You know all that rioting and shit in Tottenham.
And Brixton.
Yeah, now it's spreading all over. There's a big crowd getting together on the high street. 100 kids already and no sign of boy them anywhere. It's kicking off.
Fuck we waiting here for,
Chip said.
That's what we're doing tonight, right? Let's breeze.
They all rose.
You coming, Pops?
Little Mark asked.
Nah, bruv, I got things to do.
Pinky stopped and looked at him quizzically.
Where you heading?
Homerton.
Going for the park?
Pop said he was.
I'll come with you.
You're not going with the others?
Nah, bruv, I'm not into rioting and shit. Waste of time.
Pop shrugged. He would have preferred to walk to college on his own, but he wasn't ashamed of it anymore. Who cared if they knew? And Pinky, more than the rest of them, needed to see that there were other alternatives to the street. Perhaps it would help give him a nudge to do something else, and if it didn't, if he thought worse of him, well, Pops didn't care about that any longer.
"Aye," he said to the others, "laters."
They bumped fists, and Pops had another moment of sentimental affection for them all. He quickly recalled some of the things they had done together. Long, hot summer nights smoking weed in the park, watching the world go by. He smiled at the memories. Another world. It was all finished and gone now. With Pinky loping along beside him, he set off towards the park.